Now for agribusiness news, markets, and weather from Studio C. This is Agriculture Today.
It has been significant for the feed yards in the U.S. When we talk about beef on dairy.
Brady Miller is with Texas Cattle Feeders Association.
If we compare and we look back at what we saw in 11-12, we replaced a lot of those animals with Holstein animals, especially in the South, in the feed yards in the South. This time it wasn't Holsteins, it was beef on dairy. So we're still talking about dairy that came in, especially for the feed yards in the South, and filled that gap. And then the other piece of this that we're going to talk about and cannot, go too far in this discussion without talking about Mexican cattle crossing the border in the South and the significant part that they play in that gap stop as well.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
We get tired of giving massive amounts of money to countries that hate us, don't we?
Speaking to Republican members of the House, President Donald Trump.
And I created the new Department of Government Efficiency, and I think it's going to be very meaningful. I terminated the ridiculous and incredibly wasteful Green New Scam, one of the great scams in history. Actually, isn't it 12 years up? They gave us 12 years to live, right? I think that we passed it, right? We're still around. Can you believe it? You know, the person that really came up with it is a person that never even took a course on the environment, was a poor student, not a good student, didn't understand a lot, and she came up with this idea, and everybody all of a sudden started going, and then mainstream, you know, important Democrat leaders were starting, you know, they got sucked into it, and we've spent trillions of dollars on just like throwing it out the window. You could throw it out the window, you would have been better off. I withdrew from the one-sided Paris Climate Accord.
His comments ahead of shutting down U.S. aid with the help of Elon Musk.
I'm looking forward to working with Congress on a reconciliation bill that financially takes care of our plans to totally and permanently restore the sovereign borders of the United States once and for all. This should include full funding for a record increase in border security personnel and retention bonuses for ICE and Border Patrol.
The White House also releasing a fact sheet dealing with the tariffs. It says that it's addressing an emergency situation that the extraordinary threat posed by illegal aliens and drugs, including deadly fentanyl, constitutes a national emergency under the International Emergency Economics Power Act. So with that, President Trump implementing a 25% additional tariff on imports from Canada and Mexico and a 10% additional tariff on imports from China. Energy resources from Canada will have a lower 10% tariff, according to the White House. Now, the orders make clear that the flow of contraband drugs like fentanyl to the U.S. through illegal and illicit distribution networks has created the national emergency.
Our administration will also be working to implement the Make It in America plan that I outlined very successfully in my campaign. You know, I think my campaign, I really focused on the border more than anything else. A lot of people said the biggest thing was inflation and the economy, and then maybe the border was third. I always felt the border was first, because I felt that people could really understand that you can't have people pouring in from the prisons all over the world and from mental institutions all over the world and dumped into our country. So I talked about that much more so than I did inflation. I mean, inflation was terrible. It was the worst. I think it was the worst in the history of our country. But you can only talk about it so long. You know, the price of apples doubled. The price of bacon is quadrupled. The price, everything is a disaster. And you say it, and then what do you do? With this, I could give examples of what they're doing to destroy our country. And I felt it was the strongest thing. You know, it's funny, in 2016, I won on the border. In 2020, we did so well, I couldn't talk about the border. My people would say, sir, don't bring up the border. Nobody wants to hear it. I said, no, I did a great job. It was a horrible border in 2016. But that border was beautiful compared to what we have now.
Already, Mexico and Canada responding with tariffs of their own. It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
The restless thumb leads to a restless soul.
Dan Ventiker is known online as Iowa Dairy Farmer. He says we're over-consuming social media.
So right now it might be fine. You might be scrolling 3 hours a day, and that 3 hours a day, for me, it was like 3 to 4 hours a day. So you think, oh, Dan's just sitting on his couch for 3 hours straight. That's not what it is. It's, here's 10 minutes while the cow's waiting to go into the robot. Oh, the kids are done with their supper and everybody's quiet. I'll take 10 minutes. Oh, I'm sitting on the toilet. Here's 20 minutes. And then, the kids are in bed. Here's an hour. It all adds up. And that all still counts to overconsumption.
Ventiker, speaking at the recent Farm Bureau annual meeting, talks about trials and social media.
I bring up our journey with cancer because a lot of that, and unexpectedly so, some people expect it, it relates to our journey with social media, and I want to talk about that. And what I want you guys to kind of ruminate on, see what I did there? What I want you to ruminate on is when we go through trials, when we go through things that don't go well, like cancer, how well do we suffer? So if you're a person of faith, you could phrase it this way. If you want to know how holy you are, how well do you suffer? Or if you're a person who just wants to be a virtuous person, if you want to know how virtuous you are, how well do you go through trials? How well do you suffer? And that's a question we faced going through that. But it's an even bigger question we faced going through some of the trials we had with social media. So, a lesson I want to get across to everybody is don't make people feel stupid. And I have another way to phrase this here in a minute. So back in high school, I was a junior in high school, and this is where this lesson really got burned into my mind, is we were at this little Christmas party, and there was a little snowstorm coming, which it wasn't like a really bad one. So we didn't cancel the Christmas party. We decided to keep it going. There was one guy who pulled in, and he said he was going to leave early because of the snow. And I kind of thought maybe he was being a wimp. So I had made a comment to him. I knew he drove a car, and I knew like trucks, two-wheel drive trucks, they're horrible in snow. Especially if they don't have four-wheel drive. Rear-wheel drive vehicles suck. Everybody knows that. So I made a comment to Jordan, like, why are you leaving? Like, I thought cars did well in the snow. The next 5 minutes were spent making me feel incredibly stupid because Jordan drove a Ford Mustang. And I knew that, but I didn't know Ford Mustangs were rear-wheel drive. So for the next 5 minutes, him, three other people, and who was now my ex-girlfriend at the time, spent the next 5 minutes just making me feel stupid for not knowing that a Mustang is rear-wheel drive. I did not know that knowing a Mustang is rear-wheel drive is common knowledge, like something we're all supposed to be born with. Everybody in that room, evidently everybody knew Mustangs are rear-wheel drive but me. So it was an opportunity to make me feel stupid. So the lesson is, don't blame people for not knowing what they don't know. I don't blame people for not knowing that bulls aren't killed at birth. I don't blame you for not knowing cows don't care about cow-calf separation. I don't blame you for not knowing we benefit the environment, not hurt it. People don't know what they don't know. And in agriculture, we have a tendency to kind of take advantage of that, because we were born and raised in this. Like, you can't teach what farmers know in 1, 2, or 3 year class. So we know a lot of things, and we tend to sometimes, unfortunately, and maybe even accidentally, make other people feel stupid for not knowing what we know. So like a small example of this is just last year, I was on TikTok and I commented on another farmer's post. And he's a great guy. He's a younger farmer, but he has a planter, and it's a 3-point planter. And it's a 3-point planter where the arms fold up like this. Some of you are nodding. You know what? I've never seen one of those. In Iowa, everything hooks up to the drawbar. Iowa, Wisconsin, like dairy country, everything hooks up to the drawbar. So we were asking, like, why do you have a 3-point planter, like a 16-row planter that does this? And a lot of people were asking the comment. Well, his next video is addressing the answer to that. And he says, like, his kind of tone was, well, let's use some common sense, right? Like, we do seed corn, obviously, so duh, we need this kind of planter. I'm like, well, why is that common sense? We don't know you do seed corn. And number two, if you're not a farmer, what the heck is seed corn? So I know, like, if I go back to that profile and I have a question, I am way more hesitant to ask him a question because I was made to feel stupid for asking what kind of planter do you run.
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
3 Mile Island, nobody died there. Fukushima, nobody died there.
James Walker is CEO of Nano Nuclear Energy. He talks about the safety of nuclear energy.
I think the only recorded incidence of death was at Chernobyl, and that's a very unusual situation where safety systems were shut down for an exercise, and they weren't even allowed to intervene in an exercise where they were deliberately trying to break a reactor system. But outside of that, like, you know, the worst disaster ever in U.S. history. Was 3 Mile Island, and nobody died. Fukushima, which was responsible for the decline of the nuclear industry in the 2010s, nobody died there either. And so the misconception, I think, around the safety of nuclear is a big barrier that actually we need to get around. And actually, it's really about communicating things to the public. And I think one important thing to note is that, if you were to look at deaths per gigawatt hour for all technologies, and you include wind and solar even in that equation, nuclear beats out everything. It beats out gas, coal, obviously, but it beats out hydro, wind, solar, geothermal. It's the safest form of energy that we've ever devised as a species. And that's really the message I think people should try and take away, that it is that safe. We really should take advantage of it. Like, it could be enormously beneficial to our kind.
Nanonuclear energy builds micro reactors. Could they work in rural America?
This is actually the main industry we targeted, because some of the larger small modular reactors which are currently being produced at the moment, they're still targeting producing for cities and towns. But micro reactors, they're targeting more rural communities. They're targeting remote mining sites, remote industry, places where it could be even off-grid, island communities, military bases, things like that. Like, this is really where the technology can really shine here, because typically the cost of remote diesel in these locations is expensive. It's quite exorbitant. And even looking at what you pay for some of these remote diesel, if you have a micro reactor and it's deployed to a site for 15 to 20 years, it can provide fuel that is more power, that is more economic than that diesel. So even from our own business, it would be not selling a reactor, but selling the power over a contracted period of time, whether that's 15, 20 years. And we'd be confident we can do that for a lot of locations at a cheaper rate than the remote diesel would cost that community. So it certainly could be very beneficial. And, you know, you mentioned the current administration and the next administration, but and you also mentioned the USDA at the beginning of the call, but they also have a mandate to increase the economic activity of rural areas. So that's why they have involvement in this. But this opens up enormous economic opportunities for rural areas, because a lot of the time power constraints can be the limiting factor for where you put your industry, where you put your facilities, whether a mine deposit is actually economic or not. Do you want to just import diesel on a daily basis for a big operation? And if you produce a lot of ore, you're going to have to truck it a long distance to a smelter or somewhere like that. So it could really revolutionize remote locations, because up until now, the only technology that has been suitable across the board where, you know, you don't have optimal wind or optimal solar or power transmission lines running or a dam or something like that has been diesel generators. And we can change that for the first time. And it's not like the technology hasn't been done before. Actually, the States has a good record of making these microreactors for universities. There's something like 24 of these microreactors that have gone out to universities in the past, but they've been used for experimental work, training work, irradiating materials, that kind of thing. You know, if we do this commercially for the first time, and we want to be the first company to do this commercially in the world.
It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
The big tariff view is going to be studied, and the president launched that in an executive order where he asked the Commerce Department and the USTR to study the tariff model long term.
Commerce Secretary Howard Lutnick on the difference between action and ordinary tariffs.
The short term issue is illegal migration, and worse even still, fentanyl coming into this country and killing over 100,000 Americans. There's no war we could have that would kill 100,000 Americans. The president is focused on ending fentanyl coming into the country. You know that the labs in Canada are run by Mexican cartels. So this tariff model is simply to shut their borders with respect. Respect America. If we are your biggest trading partner, show us the respect. Shut your border and end fentanyl coming into this country. So it is not a tariff per se. It is an action of domestic policy. Shut your border and stop allowing fentanyl into our country, killing our people. So this is a separate tariff to create action from Mexico and action from Canada. And as far as I know, they are acting swiftly. And if they execute it, there will be no tariff. And if they don't, then there will be. But it's an action-oriented model. That's not the ordinary tariff. The ordinary tariffs need to be studied and examined. And that will start, as the EO said, in April.
The action tariffs have been established against Mexico, Canada, 25%, 10% against China.
That's sort of in April. Those studies will come out in the end of March and April, and then you'll hear about those at that time. So big macro issues with tariff are being studied, but the micro issue is Canada and Mexico and the precursors from China, they need to end, and we need to protect our Americans from fentanyl. And our trading partners in Canada and Mexico, they should end it and stop disrespecting us and allowing this to come through our borders.
The other side of tariffs is bringing domestic manufacturing back to the U.S.
Well, we are going to study the actions and the economy of America and how it works. But if you think about it, we need to grow domestic manufacturing. As you said, Michigan is one of the great places where we build things. And the car manufacturing went to Canada, it went to Mexico. It is important that that come back to Michigan and come back to Ohio and come back to the great states of America that can build. And so I think a thoughtful tariff policy that drives domestic manufacturing, I think, is fundamental to the American workers, especially to the workers in Michigan.
Well, Trump doesn't necessarily have Congress behind him at this point, especially from the Democrats. Ron Wyden, senator from Oregon.
I've had more than 1,100 open to all town hall meetings in my state. I'll have several more this weekend. The second word I hear from Oregonians in those meetings is almost always bill. Grocery bill, medical bill, electricity bill. Americans feel held down by the cost of living. They look at the growing fortunes at the top and they weigh that against their sense that America's middle class just doesn't have the opportunities to really get ahead. The American people voted for change, and more than anywhere else, they want change in the economy. I don't believe they're going to get it from Mr. Besant or Donald Trump.
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
There's about 4,600 banks in the United States, and community banks represent 97% of those 4,600 banks.
Mark Scanlon is Senior Vice President of Ag and Rural America with the Independent Community Bankers of America.
We have about 70 to 75% of banks, community banks in rural areas. They provide about 80% of the farm real estate loan financing and 75% of the farm operating debt. So they're very big in terms of the agricultural scene and in terms of how much they contribute from the overall banking community to farmers and ranchers and our rural citizens and rural America. They provide a very vital link because they are high touch type of operations. They know their customers. Many cases they've known them for many years and walk in the door and greet each other on a first name basis. So I think they play a very vital role. They're very important in ensuring that farmers and ranchers and others in rural America have access to financing, which is very important to keep their operations going.
Says when it comes to ag lending, it requires a unique knowledge regarding each individual borrower.
No, it's very technical in many cases. And, with agriculture, it can be a very cyclical business. And it's also impacted by forces that are beyond our control with adverse weather that's unpredictable. And so you kind of, have to know what's gone on before and what to expect. And agriculture operates with very tight margins. So, you need to be aware of what you're doing as a banker in order to be able to help customers that are operating on thin margins. And there's a variety of different types of customers, from young farmers to many that have been in business for decades. So, you have to know the business model that they're operating under and kind of what their situation is. So that's where the high touch, know your customer type of relationship is very vital.
Scanlon watched as the House Ag Committee approved a farm bill last year but can never get it on the floor. He says this year, Mike can do it a lot quicker.
Maybe have a few hearings. I don't think they need as many hearings as they've on this new farm bill because they've already had a lot. So I think they could go through a committee process where they pass a new bill. And the good thing about that is the text has already been written with the House Ag Committee's Farm Bill, and the Senate has been working on text as well. So I think they could pass bills out of those, out of the House and Senate Ag Committees fairly soon in the next year, so that maybe by spring or early summer you're having a farm bill that is marching towards the floor and getting passed. So I think they could act relatively quickly on that. I would say also the tax package coming out of, you know, we'll extend the tax cuts. I think that will be one of the first big bills out of the gate as well. And we're certainly supportive of that. And there's a lot in those, in the tax package for agriculture as well. So those two issues will be, I think, early out of the gate in 2025.
Mark Scanlon with the Independent Community Bankers of America. It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
Whenever we look at 2024, and we know this has been coming, that this has been what we're seeing in the markets happen, it's been a long road to get to where we're at.
Brady Miller is Director of Markets, Membership, and Education with the Texas Cattle Feeders Association, says to see where we are today, we need to look back in the rearview mirror.
And when you talk about looking all the way back 10 years, maybe a little bit more than 10 years, but it's history that we got to look at, because if we don't remember history, then the future can sneak up and bite us. But whenever I talk about looking at the past, I'm talking about looking at the drought back in 11 and 12, and how did the markets react coming out of that drought? And what did we do as we were coming out of that drought? Now, I can sit here and tell you that by no means is coming out of that drought is similar to what we're seeing today. But as we move forward, we had another significant drought in 22-23. And so, but we still got to look back at 11-12 and say, okay, this is what we did. This is what happened. These were the numbers that we looked at coming out of 11-12 as we rebuilt the herd, and we saw record prices at the time. Going full speed about 10 years ahead to the 22-23 drought, and what are we doing there? And are we going to react similar, or are we going to be somewhere close? I'm going to say and tell you it's similar, not exact, but it is close to what we saw then is what we're probably going to see now. And so when you look at and you ask where are we at in 2024 and what are we going to be remembered for in 2024? Of course, in 2024, we hit some record prices. I'd call it a yo-yo. I mean, we hit those record prices. We dropped back down and then we would bounce right back and hit and test or not break a new record. And so with that being said, it all comes down to cow herd size and inventory in the country. Of course, we're fixing to see our new inventory prices, or not prices, but report that comes out here tomorrow afternoon, and that's going to tell us a lot. But when you harvest, or when we lose 1 million head of cows out of the marketplace coming out of the drought of 2022-2023, it's going to have a significant effect on the markets moving forward.
The fact, however, is that we have the tightest supply of cattle in history. But could the stars be aligning for the industry to rebuild?
What I will tell you, based off of our internal data, now he's looking at national data. I'm gonna kind of zero in on the TCFA three-state area and the information that we collect every month. What I will tell you for the industry in the South, and I'm going to look back at history again. You're going to get tired of me talking about the drought of 11 and 12, but I feel like we have to look at that to kind of have an idea of what we might be seeing now. So if we go back to 11 and 12, when we bottomed out, let me start here. Typically in our three-state area, we typically run about 41% heifers on feed. That is a normal range. That's typically what the split is, 41% heifers on feed, 59% steers on feed. What I can tell you for the last two or three months is that we have been running in the low 30s. We've been running around 33% heifers on feed. Now, am I going to sit here and tell you that that means that we're in a deep rebuilding phase? I don't think I'm comfortable enough to sit here and tell you that, but we're getting close, and it's been a couple months here that we've been running in that low 30 range that I'm getting pretty comfortable to say, okay, now we're getting to the point in the South, at least, that I feel like we're probably more in a rebuilding phase now than what I could have sat here and told you 2 months ago.
It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
What is the size of the U.S. cattle herd at the start of 2025? USDA livestock analyst Mike McConnell with the numbers from the January cattle inventory report.
All cattle and calves in the United States on January 1st of this year was estimated to be 86.7 million head. That's about 1% lower than what it was a year ago.
Reflecting a continued contraction in the cattle inventory. However,
there are some indications there might be opportunities in the future for producers to retain and expand.
McConnell says some of those indicators within the cattle report include
the number of feeder animals outside feedlots is estimated to be about 24.6 million head, which is down slightly from a year ago, although it's not quite down as sharply as the total herd would be. So in addition, some of the revisions in 2024 indicated that the number of cattle outside feedlots was a little bit higher than what the numbers were estimated to be about a year ago.
Pointing to more supplies in 2024 than previously estimated, and not as sharp a tightening of supplies in 2025 in the cattle market. I'm Rod Bain reporting in Washington, D.C.